I'm going to talk to you tonight about belief, specifically the problem of religious belief. Our world has been balkanized into separate moral communities. We have Christians against Muslims, against Jews. The majority of people on this planet at the moment organize their lives around a founding proposition that God wrote one of their books. We have many of these books on hand. They make genuinely incompatible claims about the nature of this universe, about the disposition of certain real estate in the Middle East. We have the marriage of quite literally first century or earlier beliefs, literally Iron Age philosophy, with 21st century destructive technology. This on its face should seem untenable to us. So now I'm going to say some very unpleasant things about religious belief over the next hour. And I just want to warn you up front that I know I'm going to offend some people in this room. Let me assure you that's not the point. I'm not being deliberately provocative. I am simply worried. So I'm going to worry out loud for the next hour or so. I'm mindful of the fact that 90% of our neighbors, 90% of Americans, believe in a personal God. 40% of scientists believe in a personal God, literally a God who can hear our prayers. So I'm guaranteed to offend someone here. I know this is as secular an audience as I'm going to find, but I want to say up front that needless to say, I'll take your questions, as Susan said. Well, what is a belief? Let's get into this for a minute. Beliefs are clearly representations of the world, but they are more than that. They are the representations of the world that we think actually represent the world. This is the distinction between a belief and a hope, say. When you hope that something is true, you are representing the world. You are representing a possible state of the world. When you believe that something is true, you are actually making your best effort to map reality with your thoughts. And this is why beliefs pull the reins of our emotions and our behavior so closely. This is why belief is really part of the higher cognitive machinery we have to generate expectations about the world, expectations about how our behavior is going to change our moment-to-moment experience. If this sounds abstract to you, just imagine the change that would occur in you if the fire marshal came in at this moment and said this building is about to collapse. I mean, these are mere words. This is a mere sentence. And yet, should you give it credence, should you believe it to be true, it would completely transform your physiology, your neurology, your behavior rather quickly. And so too with any other proposition that has significant representational content. Believing a proposition to be true is what opens us to the representational content of any what otherwise would be a string of words. So what do our neighbors believe? Well, 22% of Americans claim to be certain, literally certain, that Jesus is going to come down out of the clouds sometime in the next 50 years. Another 22% think he probably will sometime in the next 50 years. That's 44% of the electorate. Now, of course, this belief does not exist in isolation. It's not an accident that 44% of Americans also believe that the creator of the universe literally promised the land of Israel to the Jews. This is in his capacity as an omniscient real estate broker. And these beliefs are knit together with a myriad of other beliefs, infatuations with the end of history, with apocalyptic prophecy. And these beliefs have geopolitical consequences. This is not just what people believe on Sundays. It is actually not an exaggeration to say that something like half of us, something like 44% of the American population, if they turned on their television sets and saw that a mushroom cloud had replaced New York City, they would see a silver lining in this cloud, because it would be a portent to them. It would presage that the best thing that is ever going to happen is about to happen, the return of Christ. Or take another belief. We've all been pummeled with this debate about intelligent design, the idea that the machinery of the living cell is so complicated that it could not possibly have been generated through naturalistic processes. This should be genuinely troubling to us. This really is eroding the prestige of science in our culture. It is, your children could well be taught this pseudoscience in school, in biology class, one of these days. But it's also important to recognize that it's a bit of a red herring, because 44%, actually in the last Gallup poll it was up to 53%, something like half of us are creationists. Intelligent design is not what they're fancying. They believe that we were created from mud with divine breath sometime in the last 6,000 years. You know, Adam and Eve standing in a garden with a talking snake and a hankering for apples. This is literally the vision of the creation of our species. Or take another belief that really should be, this should just be a curiosity to us until you see its consequences in the world, that the Catholic idea that condom use is somehow immoral. This is a genuinely ludicrous idea. I can assure you that the powers of the human brain are insufficient to provide a good argument for this. But map this onto sub-Saharan Africa, where literally millions, something like 3.5-4 million people, die each year from the spread of AIDS. And what you have there are Catholic ministers literally preaching the sinfulness of condom use in villages where the only information about condom use is the representation of the ministry. I mean, it seems to me that the time for respecting beliefs of this sort is long past. This is genocidal stupidity. It is criminal negligence of a sort that we would not tolerate in any other institution. Yet the Vatican cannot be criticized to the degree that it should, because it's the Vatican, and there is a overarching taboo around criticizing religious faith. We've all assimilated this idea that we should respect other people's religious beliefs. Your neighbor has the right to believe whatever he wants to about God and the moral structure to this universe. He has the right to believe whatever he wants to about what happens after death, and you should respect these beliefs merely because he believes them. Where else in our discourse do we play by these rules? When was the last time anyone in this room was admonished to respect another person's beliefs about history or geography or engineering or medicine? We do not respect people's beliefs. We evaluate their reasons. If my reasons are good enough, you will helplessly believe what I believe. That is what it is to be a rational human being. Reasons are contagious. If I came on the stage and said that the Holocaust never happened, you would be under no burden whatsoever to respect my beliefs. And we don't respect the beliefs of people who think Elvis is still alive, and the people who make all those crazy pilgrimages to Graceland. These people do not get invited to sit on our boards of directors. They don't become presidents of universities. I mean, that is all well and good, except when you change the subject to God, and then all bets are off. Then the sky's the limit. You can be certain with zero evidence and respected for it. It is taboo to push the conversation into criticism of your beliefs. So what I'm advocating, really, and what I advocate in my book, is a kind of conversational intolerance. We don't need new laws. We don't have laws against Holocaust deniers. You know, all we need is a standard of intellectual honesty, where people who pretend to be certain about things they're clearly not certain about receive some conversational pressure. I mean, this would all be accomplished if we treated everyone who spoke about God on the floor of the Senate as though they had just spoke about Poseidon. I mean, just imagine, you know, we have all these hurricanes in the Gulf, and some senator gets it into his head that we should really be praying to Poseidon. I mean, this, after all, is his jurisdiction. This is, the ocean is reclaiming our cities. Clearly, that would be the end of that person's political career. Yet it's not like someone discovered in the 3rd century that the biblical God exists, but Poseidon doesn't. These claims have exactly the same status. So there is a conflict between religion and science. Many of us, many scientists, have papered over this conflict. And no less a body than the National Academy of Sciences, really our most elite scientists, has announced that there is no conflict, that religion and science ask different questions and represent different ways of knowing. Well, religion and science don't ask different questions, and they don't represent different ways of knowing. Every religion is making claims about the way the world is. If Jesus does come down out of the clouds like a superhero, Christianity will stand revealed as a science. That will be the science of Christianity. Every Christian will be able to say, "Told you so. I mean, here he is. Look at his magic powers." And a sufficient display of magic powers, it would just take a few minutes, would convince any scientist of the claims of Christianity. I mean, take this idea that religion and science are mutually compatible and ask different questions, and broadcast it onto the current debate about stem cell research. I mean, from a biological point of view, stem cell research is one of the most promising areas of research in biology to generate medical therapies for scores of conditions. There are literally tens of millions of people in our own country suffering from diabetes, from spinal cord injury, Parkinson's, full body burns. And stem cell research is, while who knows when and how it will pan out, any biologist will tell you this is what we should be doing, and yet we're not funding it at the federal level. The concern from the religious point of view is that we have to destroy 3-day-old human embryos to conduct this research. And the ethical debate stops there. It is just merely asserted from the religious point of view that 3-day-old human embryos have souls. You have souls in the petri dish. You have souls in the little girl with diabetes. You can't, you know, the interests of, who can weigh the interests of one soul against another? We never have to get into the details because faith stops the conversation. You just have to respect the faith proposition that life starts at the moment of conception, whatever that means. Well, let's talk about the details for a second. Perhaps it sounds scary to destroy human embryos. A 3-day-old human embryo is a collection of 150 cells. They're arranged in a sphere. There's no brain. There's no nervous system. Maybe 150 cells sounds like a lot of cells. There are 100,000 cells in the brain of a fly. Flies have brains. They have neurons. They have neurons very much like our own. If we know anything at all about the relationship between physical complexity and the possibility of having experience, at the possibility of having interests, we know that more suffering is visited upon this earth every time we swat a fly than when we kill a 3-day-old human embryo. It's not enough to say they're potential human beings. You know, given the advances in genetic engineering, every cell in the human body with a nucleus is a potential human being given the right manipulation. Every time the president scratches his nose, he's engaged in a holocaust of potential human beings. Take the idea that there are souls in these embryos. Well, embryos at this stage can split into twins. So what happens? We have one soul that becomes two souls. Embryos at an even later stage can fuse into what's called a chimera, becoming a single individual. So we have two souls coming into one soul. The arithmetic of souls doesn't make sense. No one is ever burdened with the responsibility of trying to make sense of it, because faith stands in for ethical argument. So my argument to you, really, and my argument in my book, is that either you have good reasons for what you believe, or you don't. If you have good reasons, your beliefs are part of the general purview of scientific rationality. You know, we don't need to distinguish between hard science and soft science. This includes history. This includes all intellectual discourse where people honestly represent the state of the evidence and seek evidence. And religion is the only area of our lives where having no reasons or having very tenuous reasons is considered a boon, really. It's often considered even more ennobling to take this on faith rather than, I mean, this is the parable of Doubting Thomas. So having noticed this confrontation between religion and science and faith and reason generally, many of us have become what is now called religious moderates. Religious moderation really is the flavor of religion that is acceptable to so many people who are otherwise rigorously honest in intellectual terms. And in my book, I criticize religious moderation rather harshly, and this has actually been some of the most controversial material in my book. So I just want to run through my argument briefly about this, because it has raised some hackles. The first thing to say up front is just that religious moderation is better than fundamentalism. There's no doubt about that. Religious moderates don't fly planes into buildings. Religious moderates don't organize their lives around apocalyptic prophecy, and that's a very good thing. But religious moderation has some real problems. The first is that it gives cover to fundamentalism. Because religious moderates have made it taboo to criticize faith, they want faith respected. They want the whole project of being religious, being identified as a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, to be respected. That it is impossible to call into question this basic project, that the ethical tenability of raising a child to believe he's a Christian as opposed to anything else. And under the cover of this respect, we are now powerless to say the very harsh and necessary things about religious extremism that we need to say, because it is taboo. You have to respect faith. Religious moderation prevents us from even noticing the differences among our religions. It is taboo to notice that all our religions are not teaching the same thing. They're not all equally wise, and where they do teach the same thing, they don't teach it equally well. I mean, where are the Tibetan Buddhist suicide bombers? If you think for a moment that the kind of violence we see in the Muslim world is born of the Israeli occupation and our misadventures in Iraq, we should see Tibetan Buddhist suicide bombers. The Tibetans have suffered an occupation every bit as brutal and far more cynical than any that we or the British or the Israelis have imposed upon the Muslim world. Something like 1.2 million Tibetans have died since the Chinese occupation. Where are the throngs of Tibetans in the streets calling for the deaths of Chinese non-combatants? Where are the Tibetans blowing themselves up on Chinese buses, at weddings, in crowds of children, in front of the offices of the Red Cross and the UN? It's not happening. It's not likely to happen. It's not that you could not possibly form a death cult out of the principles of Tibetan Buddhism. In fact, to some degree, Zen Buddhism informed the worldview of the kamikaze pilots during World War II. But you would have to work very hard to bend the core principles of Buddhism into this kind of orgy of violence. You don't have to work so hard as a Muslim. And it would be impossible as a Jain. I mean, the Jains, this religion of India that has some 10 million subscribers, I think, the core of their religion is nonviolence. No matter how deranged you get by your doctrine as a Jain, you will get less and less violent. I mean, the really religious Jains cover their mouths with cheesecloth so they don't inhale a bug. By no stretch of the imagination can you argue that the core principle of Islam is nonviolence. It is taboo to notice this, and it is especially taboo among religious moderates. Our own religious demagogues will notice this. We can have, you know, Franklin Graham will stand up and say, Islam is an evil religion. They'll notice the differences between religions. Everyone else has the wrong religion. But religious moderates have rendered this taboo. I want to point out that I'm not talking about a race or ethnicity. I'm talking about the consequences of ideas. I'm talking about, when I talk about Islam, I'm talking about John Walker Lynn, the white guy from Marin County who went off to fight with the Taliban. We are at war, to digress briefly into our current situation, we are at war with Islamic fundamentalism. Not merely Al-Qaeda, not extremist Islam. The mainstream doctrine of Islam contains this notion of martyrdom and jihad. It contains this imperative to convert, subjugate, or kill infidels. Anyone who says it doesn't has not read the Quran, has not read the Hadith, or is lying about them. It is taboo to notice this. If you doubt this, if you think, I'm sure there are people in this room who are still thinking, no, it can't be religion. This is lack of economic opportunity. It's lack of educational opportunity in the Muslim world. Just contemplate for a moment the biographies of the 19 men who woke up on September 11th, 2001 and decided to slit the throats of stewardesses and fly planes into buildings. These guys were college educated to a man. Many of them had PhDs. Many of them had been educated in the West. They were middle class or better. I don't know how many architects and engineers need to hit the wall at 400 miles an hour for us to get it into our heads that this is not merely a problem of education or economics. These were not guys who had spent a lot of time agitating about regime change in the Middle East. These were guys who spent an inordinate amount of time at their local mosque in Hamburg talking about the pleasures that await martyrs in paradise and demonizing infidel culture. The circumstance we are in is much more sinister than many want to realize. It is possible to be so well educated that you can build a nuclear bomb and to still think you're going to get the 72 virgins in paradise. That is how partitioned the human mind is, and that is how balkanized our discourse is. That is how immune religious propositions are to critical pressure, conversational pressure in our discourse. 40% of scientists believe in a biblical God. That does not suggest that there are good scientific reasons to believe in a biblical God. That suggests that 60% of scientists are not doing their jobs. That there really is an argument to be won here. So the problem with religious moderation, another problem, is that moderates are blinded by their own moderation. A moderate doesn't know what it's like to be certain of paradise. A moderate doesn't know what it's like to be certain of God, to be certain that the book he keeps by his bedside is the perfect word of the creator of the universe. And so when the moderate looks, sees the jihadist in the video camera saying things like, we love death more than the infidel loves life, and then he blows himself up, it's the moderate who's left wondering, well, that couldn't be faith. That's propaganda, I don't know what that was, but that's not religion. So it is really the discourse of religious moderation that keeps convincing us that religion is not the problem, that this violence would happen anyway, that these 19 guys would have killed a lot of people anyway. There's no evidence for that. Another problem with religious moderation is that it is intellectually bankrupt. It really represents a fundamentally unprincipled use of reason. At least fundamentalists talk about evidence. Fundamentally, you ask a fundamentalist, why do you believe that Jesus was the Son of God and the Bible is the perfect word of God? You'll get reasons. They're not good reasons, but you will immediately see that these people are engaged in an evidentiary pursuit. They'll say things like, the New Testament confirms all of Old Testament prophecy, or every prophecy in the Bible has come true. You know, these are specious claims, but contrast that to what moderates say. Moderates don't talk about evidence. Moderates talk about meaning. They talk about the good effects of believing as they do. Now, just take that kind of talk into another area. Just change God to some other consoling proposition and appreciate what a non sequitur that is as to the question, why do you believe in God? This is actually an example from my book. Imagine your neighbor believes that he's got a diamond buried in his backyard that's the size of a refrigerator. And you ask him why. And he says things like, well, you don't understand. This diamond gives my life a lot of meaning. Or, my family loves the gatherings we have on the lawn digging this pit every Sunday. And are we going to take that away from us? Or imagine if he said, I wouldn't want to live in a universe where there wasn't a diamond buried in my backyard that's the size of a refrigerator. It's pretty clear, it's immediately clear, that those responses would be inadequate. Deeply inadequate. Those really are the responses of a madman or an idiot. And yet, take the same kind of thinking into the religious domain, and these responses have immense prestige. In fact, unless you endorsed some thinking of that kind, you could not possibly get elected to political office in this country. Another problem with religious moderation is that it is theologically bankrupt. It is not like if we just read the books more closely, we would discover all these reasons to be moderates. I got news for you. I've read the books. God is not a moderate. What you find in these books, there's no place in the books where God says, you know, when you get to the new world and you develop your three branches of government and you have a civil society, you can just jettison all the barbarism I recommended in the first books. These books really are engines of fundamentalism. They are engines of intolerance. There really is a wrathful Jesus in the New Testament, waiting to be found in 2 Thessalonians and in Revelation, where exactly the Jesus who we have in the Left Behind series of novels that 60 million people have bought. You know, the Jesus of just fiery wrath who's going to throw people into the pit. Okay, that is there to be discovered. Nowhere in the book does it say, oh, that's bogus. It's not an accident that people like St. Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine, but really the people who are still taught as the great lights of the Western tradition. In Aquinas' case, he thought heretics should be killed outright. In Augustine's case, he thought they should be tortured. Augustine's argument for the use of torture laid the foundations for the Inquisition. This is not an accident, and it's perfectly reasonable. We have this idea that the fact that we were burning heretics alive for five centuries in Europe, this represented some kind of departure, a civilizational departure into psychopathology. It didn't. It is perfectly reasonable to do this if you believe the books. The heretic next door, given certain beliefs, is far more dangerous than the child molester next door. The heretic can say something to your child that will damn his soul for all time. Religious moderates lose touch with the fact that it's possible to believe this. And finally, the problem with religious moderation is that because it is constitutive of merely our relaxing our hold upon these ancient superstitions and taboos, because it doesn't call the basic project of affiliating yourself with these traditions into question. It doesn't call into question the project of venerating these books to the exclusion of any other books. Because it doesn't, it prevents us from developing modern 21st century alternatives, really bringing the full measure of our creativity to bear on questions of human happiness. Now, this link between religion and morality that we really is everywhere in our culture, and which really underwrites religious moderation and religious fundamentalism to a significant degree. This idea that without religion, something fundamental would be lost to us in moral terms. This really is questionable when you look at the books. The truth is that not even, to speak specifically of the Bible for a moment, not even an Orthodox Jew or a fundamentalist Christian can take God at his word, given how sadistic God is in books like Leviticus and Deuteronomy and Exodus. I mean, if you were going to draw your to-do list out of a book like Leviticus, you would make Mullah Omar of the Taliban look like Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I mean, it paints a vision of life so needlessly horrible, so subversive of the basic project of creating a sustainable society where human happiness is even possible, that we effectively have edited the Bible. Even fundamentalists have. But it's important to point out that nobody ever says these passages are immoral. I mean, the idea that you find that a woman is not a virgin on her wedding night, and you stone her to death. You stone homosexuals to death. If your kids talk back to you, you stone them to death. If you go into a town and you see someone praying to a foreign god, you kill him, you kill his family, you kill everyone in the town. Okay, these are not metaphors. These are not analogies for some spiritual struggle within. These are explicit directives to kill people for theological crimes. No one ever says this is immoral. Christians just say we don't have to do this anymore because Jesus brought us the doctrine of grace. Well, incidentally, Jesus also said that every jot and every tittle of the law has to be fulfilled. So the inquisitors of the Middle Ages had a rationale for practicing this kind of law. And I can assure you that St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas had read the Sermon on the Mount. They managed to square the ministry of Jesus with their impulses to kill people for thought crimes. I mean, if this is the best book we have, from the point of view of fundamentalism, the Bible is the best book we have, or the Quran is the best book we have, because it's literally been dictated by the creator of the universe. From the point of view of moderation, these are the best books we have, but who knows what their source is. Just the smartest people who ever lived wrote these books, say. If the Bible is the best book we have in the West, in ethical terms, we should be practicing slavery. The creator of the universe clearly expects us to keep slaves. He simply tells us not to beat our slaves so severely that we put out their eyes or their teeth. Jesus clearly expected us to keep slaves. He never criticizes the institution of slavery. He uses analogies with slaves. Paul in 1 Timothy admonishes slaves to serve their masters well and to serve their Christian masters especially well so that they can partake in their holiness. The abolitionists were absolutely on the wrong side of the theological debate. If this is the wisest book we have, the slaveholders of the South were right. And on so many other questions, this is true. If this is the wisest book we have, we should be beating our children with rods. It says in Proverbs. Incidentally, fundamentalist Christians in our country are beating their children with rods. Last year alone, in Alabama, 40,000 kids were paddled in their schools. It's legal to do this. This is a faith-based initiative. It's important for us to recognize that we decide what is good in the good book. We cherry-pick these books based on our own ethical intuitions. All we have to decide questions of ethics are our own ethical intuitions and the ethical intuitions of others who we are in conversation with. You can put your faith in a 21st century conversation about ethics, Or you can put your faith in a first century conversation as preserved in these books. And the problem of faith really is that it is a conversation stopper. As long as you don't have to give reasons for what you believe, you have effectively immunized yourself against the power of human conversation. I mean, you hear religious people say things like, there's nothing you can say that will change my mind. I mean, just imagine that said in medicine. You know, if there's nothing that can be said that will change your mind, if there's no evidence or argument that can be adduced, that proves that you are not taking any state of the world into account in your beliefs. The problem with this is that when the stakes are high, we have a choice between conversation and violence. At the level of society, we have a choice between conversation, negotiation, and war. The only willingness to take on and consider new evidence and new argument guarantees that this human collaboration is open-ended. Only that willingness guarantees that. Religion is the one area of discourse where we have made a fetish of a very different frame of mind. And this leads to two kinds of violence, two kinds of conflict. I mean, first we can concede that there are other sources of human conflict. You know, there would be wars without religion. There's tribalism, there's nationalism, there's racism, ethnic rivalry. But there's no kind of us-them thinking that really makes a transcendental object of the differences between in-group and out-group. I mean, the difference between you and your neighbor is not merely skin color, it's not merely language, it's not merely politics, it's not merely that you want his belongings, it's that this difference, this means something for eternity. And so what you have are populations of people who organize their moral identities around their religious affiliation, whether or not they care so much about the theological details. And this leads to conflict when a society is stressed. Over and over again, we see societies breaking down along religious lines. This happened in Ireland, Bosnia. You know, it's not that the Irish were fighting over the doctrine of the transubstantiation, but their identities, their core moral identities, were built around religious affiliation. Then there's the other kind of religious violence, which is explicitly theological, where you literally have people killing other people because they think the creator of the universe wants them to do it, and they think there will be a reward for doing it. And the preeminent example of this is what we see every day on the front page of the paper, that this jihadist violence. So my argument to you really, and my argument in my book, is that unless we call into question the dogma of faith, unless we call into question the idea that beliefs can be sanctified by something other than evidence and argument, we will never successfully undercut the basis for religious violence. Now, I've said many nasty things about religious faith. This is not to say that religion is merely a shell game. This is not to say that all religion is just a tissue of lies and misconceptions and cognitive errors designed to anesthetize us against our fear of death. It is that to some significant degree, but it is more than that. There is no doubt that people have spiritual experiences. I use this word spiritual and mystical in my book, and I use them in scare quotes because, frankly, there are many embarrassing associations with these terms. But there is no doubt that people have extraordinary transformative experiences and can have them deliberately. Every culture has produced people who have gone off into caves for 40 days or 40 years and discovered that a deliberate use of attention, of introspection through meditation, through prayer, this can really transform the human mind. And the testimony we have on this subject comes to us through our religious traditions. And unfortunately, therefore, it is mingled with all manner of superstition and dogma. And it's not mingled to the same degree in every tradition. And this is also taboo, to notice that our contemplative traditions, our spiritual traditions, are not equally insightful. East and West, for instance. It's a bit of a cultural mystery as to why this is so, but the Eastern tradition has been, the Indian tradition generally and Buddhism especially, has been so much more sophisticated, so much more empirical in their study of first-person experience, or just in their study of what it is possible for a human being to realize if he or she just pays close attention to the flow of experience. There are analogs in the Western tradition. There have been great Christian and Jewish and Muslim contemplatives. Yes. I mean, in the context of every ideology, there are people making the best of it. But the difference, East and West, in contemplative terms, really is like the difference between Western medicine and Eastern medicine. If you have an appendicitis, you better hope that you're near a Western hospital with a Western-trained surgeon. You don't want to see your acupuncturist. I mean, maybe there are some things that Eastern medicine is better for, but generally speaking, Western medicine is the only medicine we have. And incidentally, if you do get an appendicitis, you might consider this idea that you've been intelligently designed. If ever there were a reductio ad absurdum of intelligent design, it's the appendix. So in the West, we really have, we've had an impoverished conception of sanity, really. We've had an impoverished conception of mental health. We think that, you know, if you're walking down the street talking to yourself too much, and we all do it a little, but if you're doing it too much and not censoring yourself in front of other people, you're crazy. But if you talk to yourself all day long, silently, if you just know enough to shut up about it, but you're talking to yourself, thinking, from the moment you get out of bed to the moment you fall asleep, that's perfectly normal. That's compatible with perfect sanity. That is not the Eastern, and especially it is not the Buddhist view. I mean, in Eastern schools of meditation, they have discovered that there is an alternative to being lost in thought, moment by moment. In the West, the testimony on this subject is really thin. I mean, in the West, we have been standing on the shoulders of dwarves in contemplative terms. So I just want to briefly sketch for you what I think our contemplative traditions attest to. And this is something that is actually getting a lot of scientific interest at this point. As you probably know, there are meetings between the Dalai Lama and Western neuroscientists. I just came from one in D.C., and this was devoted specifically to the clinical applications of meditation. But there's dialogue between Western scientists generally and contemplatives about how first-person data, first-person experience, can be brought into the charmed circle of third-person experiment, and how we can use this to understand the possibilities of human well-being a little bit better. So briefly, the first fruit of this dialogue really is the insight that positive human emotions, positive human traits, are skills. They are trainable. But just as you can learn to play the piano, you can learn to feel compassion for somebody when you otherwise wouldn't. You can learn to feel joy at the success of another person rather than envy. And you can learn this because our brains are really plastic. Our brains are instruments that change based on how they are played. It's really quite magical that this is so, but it certainly seems to be so. Who knows to what degree our experience can change the brain and therefore change the possibilities of future experience. But we know that it does. And therefore, what you think matters. What you feel matters. How you, the kinds of intentions you form toward other people matters. Whether you act ethically matters. And what you pay attention to moment to moment, what you notice matters. And it even just matters for health. We know that stress is so corrosive of physical health now. We know that even if meditation did nothing other than reduce stress, it would be worth looking into. We know that the brain is intimately linked with it, obviously the autonomic nervous system, but the endocrine system, the immune system. These systems are affected by your conscious emotional life and in turn affect the brain, its physical structure. But there's a deeper message from our contemplative traditions beyond that we can change our minds. The message is there's something beyond the search for pleasure and pain. There's something beyond joy and sorrow and just the vicissitudes of human experience. And what is beyond is not some distant paradise. It is simply consciousness itself. There is this insight that consciousness, that very thing that is aware of your experience in this moment, the very thing that is hearing the sound of my voice, that is feeling the sensation of your body sitting there, that transcends its content in some basic sense. That which is aware of joy, for instance, and that which is aware of sorrow is not actually improved by joy or diminished by sorrow. And what meditation is a way of just turning consciousness upon itself to try to glimpse this fact and to glimpse the way it feels. Because it doesn't feel like a self. It doesn't feel like I. We all walk around feeling like we are the thinker of our thoughts and the experiencer of our experience. We feel like we are having experience. We're not merely identical to our experience. And this point of view is really vulnerable to inquiry. I mean, if this seems just impossibly abstract, by analogy, I just want to point out to you, maybe I can tie it down to something that we all know is so. We all know we have an optic blind spot. We all know that the optic nerve passes through the retina, and so there's a point in our visual fields where we're not getting any information. We've all probably had this demonstration done in class where you do a mark on a piece of paper and you play with it and you get the mark to disappear. Now, so it is true of you now. There's, you know, as you look out across the room, there's somebody very likely missing a head and you're not noticing it. It's falling in your blind spot. It is possible to be made to notice this. Most people don't notice it. Even those of us who know about it go for decades without noticing it. And yet it is there available to be noticed. There is an analogous insight into the nature of consciousness that is just as on the surface as that. It tends to be harder to notice. I mean, it requires most people some training in meditation to notice it. But it is possible to notice that consciousness, what that in you which is aware of your experience, does not feel like I. And there's a wealth of testimony on how this can change a person's experience of the world for the better. I mean, there's a kind of mystical well-being that is compatible with going into a cave for a year. I mean, going into a cave, for most of us, going into a cave for a year is synonymous with everything we don't want to happen to us. It separates us from everything we want out of life. It's rather interesting to point out that solitary confinement is considered a punishment even in a prison. And yet, you have contemplatives who are willing and made really quite happy by running this experiment on themselves, going into a cave for vast amounts of time and practicing meditation. My argument to you is we have to bring this end of the human, this end of the spectrum of human experience into the data of our worldview. We have to understand the possibilities of the plasticity of human experience. And our conception of human well-being has to include this. So in conclusion, I want to say that what we really need is a contemplative science. We need a way of talking about human well-being and the possibilities of human happiness that is as totally unconstrained by dogma as science is. We need to find a way of talking about the reality of death. The fact that we are all going to die is an astonishing situation. If you can just hold on long enough, you are going to witness the death of everyone you love. And this is everyone's experience. No one is going to escape this. If it is possible to be happy in this condition, if it is possible to be deeply happy in this condition, we need to understand this in terms that don't rely on divisive superstitions. If there's an important role for ritual in our lives, if we need to mark those occasions in every human life, birth and weddings and deaths with profundity, if this is actually doing some serious work for us, we need to understand this in rational terms. We need to develop language that is not first century superstition. So one way to summarize what I've said to you is that I'm really arguing that every one of us is a scientist, in that every one of us is making a claim about the way the world is. Every one of us wants to understand reality. None of us want to be confused. None of us want to be mistaken about the situation we're in. But there are areas of intellectual honesty in our culture where science is good, and there are areas where we have a fundamental double standard, where certainty has been unlinked from evidence. But just as everyone is a scientist, everyone is also a mystic, in the sense that every one of us has been born into a circumstance where we are helplessly seeking happiness in a condition where experience is always changing. What you get, you lose. And we are all interested, whether we have time to think about it or not, we are all interested in finding just how happy, how much well-being can be enjoyed in this circumstance. And in designing a civilization that can promote it. So I'm just asking you to imagine what it would be like to have a society where our conversation about human well-being could proceed totally unconstrained by dogma, where really we could bring the full measure of our creativity to bear on questions of human happiness. And my argument is that to get there, to get from here to there, the end game for civilization is not mere tolerance of other people's irrationality. It is not political correctness. It is reason. Thank you very much.
Right. As your questions are being collected, they're going to be brought to me. And meanwhile, while they're being brought, I will start off, Sam, with a few questions. One of the questions I'm asked most frequently in interviews is, and I've been asked it many times, what's to prevent you from going out and committing murder if you don't believe in God? What do you say to people who insist that there can never be any morality without religion?
Well, yeah, as you say, this is an incredibly common question. And we're all wise to prepare an answer for it. I happen to have one. One counterpoint to this suspicion is, just look at the societies where there's the least homicide, the least violent crime. These really are the most atheistic societies on the planet. I mean, if you just look at the UN Development Index, which ranks societies by violent crime, by literacy, by educational attainment, by per capita income, without exception, apart from the presence of the United States somewhere in the top 20, these are the most atheistic societies on the planet. Societies like the Netherlands and Canada and Australia, Sweden. There is no evidence whatsoever that high levels of religious adherence leads to a moral society. In fact, if you look at within our own culture, if you look at the red state, blue state divide, where are most of the murders occurring? Where are most of the teen pregnancies even? And even the abortions. These are happening in those states that have the highest level of religious adherence.
Okay. Here come your questions. I'll ask you one more while I vet these. I'd like you to pick up on some of the things you said about Eastern religion. Because it seems to me that, in a way, you give Eastern religions kind of a pass on the whole issue of rationality. For example, the Dalai Lama just had a piece in the New York Times, which I'm sure everyone here read, and there didn't seem to me to be much difference between his views on the relationship between religion and science and that of the moderate Western religions you criticize. Would you comment on that?
One problem is that we have this one word, religion, and as though this named a really a homogenous class of infatuations and doctrines. And it doesn't. Religion is a word like drug. I mean, there are drugs, you have aspirin and you have heroin. And they're not very similar in terms of their effects on a human life. And while there are many wacky and unsupportable dogmas within every religion, within Buddhism, they're different, and there's a spirit of empirical rigor that the Dalai Lama has, for instance. I mean, he's gone on record over and over again saying, if science demonstrates something, that some doctrine of Buddhism is false, then science wins. I mean, he has, to some degree, that's a blank check, because some of the doctrines to which most Buddhists are attached are doctrines that science is not likely to weigh in on anytime soon. But there is a difference, and I criticize Buddhism in a very long endnote in my book, it is distinct from Islam, and as Islam is distinct from almost every other religion at this moment.
Here is a great question from the audience. While we as adults agree with you totally, how do we begin to reach our young children or grandchildren? How do we teach our young children or grandchildren about life in this respect, when those under the age of 7, the age of reason, will not understand these ideas in the midst of this society?
Well, I think kids, unless they're conditioned otherwise, don't come into this world believing themselves to be Christians or Muslims or Jews. I mean, we give them these ideas. They don't just pluck them out of the ether. And so it seems to me that simply giving honest answers to their questions, and certainly lifting this taboo of saying, I don't know. I mean, we are so reluctant to say, I don't know. And incidentally, scientists are the people who are really good at saying, I don't know. They say, I don't know, all the time, because they're terrified that some specialist is going to be in the room who knows so much more about what they've been asked that, you can almost never get a scientist to weigh in on anything but his most narrow area of specialization. And this is slightly off topic, but notice the fact that science is paying a price for this, in that fundamentalists are really good at using the candor of science against it. I mean, whenever scientists say, I don't know, on Larry King Live, therein rush 1,000 fundamentalists, giving us the God of the gaps there. And that's really what intelligent design is. It is politics and religion masquerading as science.
Do you think the right wing actually believes in religion, or does it simply use religion to mobilize the masses to support the fight for finite natural resources like oil?
Well, that is spoken like a true religious moderate. incidentally, needless to say, I believe that most people, most of the time, really believe what they say they believe. And their allocations of time and energy attest to this. Certainly, a willingness to blow yourself up attests to this. But the people who are standing out on the sidewalks with the placards protesting homosexuality, I believe they really think homosexuality has been proscribed by God. And incidentally, that is why the First Amendment to the Constitution is not good enough to keep religion out of politics. It is only rational to be motivated by what you think is true. If you really think there is a God who hates homosexuals, it would be totally irrational to live in a society that just, happily live in a society that just tolerates homosexuality. So I actually do believe people believe these rather unbelievable things.
What percentage of your reader feedback has been hostile, and how hostile?
That's actually been a pleasant surprise. I would say at this point, something like 99% is really quite positive and quite supportive. And then there are the crazy emails, but nothing terribly scary either. So that's been good.
What in your mind is the proper relationship between atheism and libertarianism?
Actually, it's an interesting question. I've never thought about that, but there's a link in the sense that really that the core idea of libertarianism is that peaceful, honest people have the right to be left alone. And this is trespassed rather obviously by the religious right in their impulse to legislate what goes on in the bedroom and in other aspects of our privacy. So libertarians are very much, while they are conservative in ways that don't satisfy many liberals, they are fundamentally against this idea that you can intrude upon your neighbor's pursuit of happiness because you don't like his behavior. If his behavior doesn't affect you, if it doesn't affect your property, then consenting adults should be able to do whatever they want. And that seems to me a very sensible way of looking at it.
If neuroscience ultimately shows, if it hasn't already, that religious zealotry has a chemical or genetic component, then what solutions do you have to the whole question of world or religious peace? Asterisk. Note that half of all scientists are religious may be the direct measure of this genetic component.
Yeah, well, it all has a genetic and chemical component. Every aspect of our experience, and the nature-nurture divide has been somewhat oversold. Again, I would point to Western Europe. There is a level of unbelief in Western Europe, in a country like Sweden, for instance, that is just the polar opposite of our situation. Here we have something like 3 or 5% of Americans who will call themselves atheists, and maybe 10% who are just fundamentally unsure. We have 90%, basically. 83% of Americans believe that Jesus literally rose from the dead. Something like 80%, depending on how the question is asked, 60 to 80% of Swedes are atheists. So unless you're going to allege some real genetic difference between Swedes and Americans, it doesn't seem like a genetic problem. It really, to my mind, is a conversational problem.
This is related. Why is the United States going backward in terms of its attachment to religion, while the rest of the educated world, Western Europe and Asia, is going forward? In other words, what accounts for the extraordinary persistence of fundamentalism in America compared to the rest of the developed world?
Yeah, it is a persistence. I don't think it's that we're necessarily going backwards. It's certainly become more visible, and it has become politically more empowered. But the levels of fundamentalism, if you look at just the Gallup polls over the last 70-some-odd years, the numbers of people who believe that Satan literally exists, for instance, have been really constant, within a few percentage points. I mean, incidentally, it's 68% of Americans believe that Satan literally exists. And 28% believe that evolution is a scientific theory backed up by evidence. I mean, the most tenuous possible accommodation to the last 50 years of molecular biology and the last 100 years, 150 years of biology. So,
while there are many excellent and profound arguments against religion, what specific practical practices can replace the portions of religious ritual that deal with human fears and anxiety about death, for example?
Yeah, it's a good question for which I don't have any kind of comprehensive answer. I mean, it's something that I'm thinking about. It's something that we have to make up out of our own honest conversation. It's really not the kind of thing that can be engineered in advance. I mean, people just have to start being honest with one another and see where that honesty takes them. When you're not sure of something, don't pretend to be sure. And these nuances are preserved. Even fundamentalists are intellectually honest generally. I mean, no one is eager to go by the Brooklyn Bridge as a fundamentalist. I mean, they want evidence. They want an honest representation of the state of the world. It's just that we have dumbed down our conversation so much on the territory of religion that we are playing by a different standard. And so I think it's for us to find out what would take the place of superstition and taboo.
What do you think of Anne Rice's new novel about Jesus?
I haven't read it. I think I'm unlikely to read it. But she's going to sell a lot of books without me. So
I don't know. Some of you may have seen the Colbert Report about that. It said Anne Rice has gone from writing about guys who want to drink your blood to writing about a guy who wants you to drink his blood. not mine. I wish I'd thought about that. How do you restart a conversation with someone who says, nothing you can say will change my mind?
It's hard. I've been on AM radio enough to know that there are people who you can't talk to. It's really, there are doctrines that are hermetically sealed where the person like me who's going to challenge the belief has been demonized in advance as a temptation. I mean, the moment you start to sound reasonable enough so as to shake someone's faith, you are suspected of being the Antichrist. I mean, they are prepared for a sufficiently alluring counterpoint to their dogma. So in the Muslim world, this is also, I think it's a deeper problem actually, because the taboos around criticizing faith are literally enforced by capital punishment in so many Muslim countries. I mean, you take your life in your hands making the noises I'm making in any Muslim community on this planet, and it's not just in the Middle East. I mean, we're talking in a suburb of New York. It is not, this kind of conversation is not being had in the Muslim world, and we have to find some way to inspire it. But it's how we do that is a genuine problem.
Science, specifically quantum mechanics, has shown mathematically that we live in one of an infinite number of possible universes. Why is this acceptable while a belief in God is described by you as superstition?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it was Martin Rees, the Royal Astronomer of Britain, has said that inflationary physics, this idea that we could live in one of innumerable number universes, all functioning by different laws, suggests that there are probably infinite numbers, functionally infinite numbers of technologically advanced civilizations existing right now. And these technically advanced civilizations would have, almost by definition, invented computation and invented computers, and they'd be able to simulate universes on their computers. And it stands to reason there would be more of these simulated universes than actual universes. And therefore, on this reasoning, we should suspect to be in a simulation rather than in a real universe. Now, I guess the only thing I want to say about that, not being a physicist, is that physics appears to have achieved such a state of rarefaction that it's almost impossible to know when a physicist is joking. So, nobody's going to be burnt at the stake or stoned to death or imprisoned for a difference of opinion on cosmology. And I think it's for physicists to decide what is a rational claim to knowledge in the discourse of physics.
If you ever believed in a God, what happened to make you begin to question that belief?
I didn't believe in that kind of God. We've all believed many things that now embarrass us in hindsight. But I never was quite that far afield.
Do you see any downside to excessive meditation, which could result in being disassociated or spaced out?
Yeah, I can exemplify that, being disassociated and spaced out right now. It's like anything else. We are imperfect people devoting ourselves to various pursuits, and every Buddhist community, every meditative discipline has its casualties and can select for people who are not all that good at gratifying their desires in the world. So you have a lot of, the people who go into a cave for a year, not all of them are the next Buddha. Some of them are very likely quite neurotic and not happy in their lives. So it's you just have to be, you have to separate the various variables, but it's quite possible to, I would imagine, meditate in a way that isn't good for you. Good for you based on who you happen to be, or good for you because you're either doing it wrong or it's the practice is not suited to you, in the way that it's possible to exercise in a way that's not good for you. There's nothing wrong with jogging, except if you have bad knees, except if you have a bad back, except. So there's almost certainly an analogous issue with meditation.
Do you think that fundamentalist Christians in the United States would really have any objection to fundamentalist Islamic theocracies if they didn't support terrorism?
Oh, yeah, they would have an objection. It's just, it wouldn't be so troublesome. It's the wrong religion. From the point of view of Christianity, all those people are going to hell, and the Muslims have returned the favor. All the Christians are going to hell. So.
This is pretty broad, but I'll read it out. Do you think that modern secularism is an evolutionary transition to another state of consciousness, or is it the end of evolution?
I'm actually not a fan, and I've received some heat for this, I'm not a fan of words like secularism and atheism. I don't think we have to name the counterpoint to religious irrationality. We don't have words to describe not being an astrologer or not being an alchemist. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I'm not an astrologer, I'm not an astrologer. And to some degree, I think the same will work for not being duped by the false certainties of religion. We simply need to apply reason. We can talk about being rational. I don't think we have to talk about being secular.
So, Sam, why do you uppercase G and God in your book? I know the answer to that.
Well, I guess I could plead that the copy editor did it, but it's the God most people believe in. I mean, most of the readers are not believing in one God amid many other gods they think exist. There's the one God, the biblical God, which is the Quranic God.
I think we'll close with this question. Seems to me very important. What practical steps can we take as individuals in our individual lives to bring about the conversational intolerance you advocate?
Well, it's interesting, because I'm not actually recommending that we just oppose every claim to religious conviction wherever we find it. I'm not recommending that, you know, in a closed elevator, you hear someone talk about Jesus and you unleash on them. It's really just in situations like this. As a start, I think, you know, when you're at the podium or when you're writing an editorial or an opinion piece for the newspaper, or you're in a situation where you are advancing the conversation about ideas, it seems to me that we all have a moral responsibility to be deeply honest about these things. And, you know, so I'm not advocating that we all rush back and destroy every Thanksgiving dinner over these issues. But and then who knows where it would go from there? I mean, there's room certainly for being civil and just turning the other cheek.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Sam Harris is currently completing a doctorate in neuroscience to research the neural foundation for belief. The End of Faith is his first book. Visit www.norton.com for more information.